So actually, no, I'm not nervous. If I were nervous, I'd be a nervous wreck after all these years. So you just have to say, well, this is our job. We have to deal with all that stuff that could go wrong and make sure that we control it. That is our sort of approach at NASA. We don't get nervous, but we're very determined. So we make plans, we have systems, we write down everything that could go wrong, we have meetings, discuss, we make sure that that particular thing we thought of today gets fixed. We're going to go to the moon and we'll do the other things. He basically said, we're going to learn how to do gigantic projects by doing Apollo, and we will go from that knowledge and be able to take on other things that are really important and difficult. So he didn't say it's either or, he said it's and. We can do great things as long as we put our minds to them. Some people say, well, I just got to get a job, I got to earn something to eat. And other people say, well, can I get paid to help us go into space? So that's what we do here at NASA.
Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
One giant leap for womankind today.
It is the stated policy of this administration to return American astronauts to the moon within the next 5 years.
We are just over 24 hours away from history.
Today is Sunday, October 18th. It's been a while since you've last heard from us, so let's bring you guys up to speed.
California is red, not politically, but because it's on fire, and conflict has broken out in the Nagorno-Karabakh region between Armenia and Azerbaijan, and is being teased in the Ladakh region between India and China. The American president got COVID-19, was subjected to the best treatments available, and recovered, and the eldest member of the Supreme Court, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, passed away. Senate Republicans are now rushing to fill the seat. Fake GOP ballot boxes, Michigan gubernatorial kidnapping plots, massive Indonesian uprisings, record-breaking hurricanes, bin Laden conspiracies, and trillions in deficits have all dotted the headlines recently.
40 seconds in.
I'm not done. We've reached 40 million cases worldwide, including 8 million in the States. The census was terminated early, vaccine trials have stalled, as our aid packages, lockdowns have been reinstated in Europe, schools continue to reopen in the US, and unemployment recovery has paled. Critical elections are coming up in Bolivia, New Zealand, and the United States. Police brutality protests have taken massive amplitudes in Nigeria, and a housefly has reached national stardom.
All in the last 30 days. It's the middle of October, and things aren't looking too good on this planet. Fortunately for you, we're going to take a quick break from Earth on this episode of The Finch. Unfortunately, some problems still persist, even in space.
I'm Alex.
I'm Will.
This episode of The Finch is out of this world.
Thankfully.
You're listening to The Finch Podcast. So what exactly are we doing up there? It may seem like a sort of scientific playground. Three humans are rotating around in the International Space Station at 17,000 miles per hour, 250 miles above us. Nearly 3,000 satellites and millions of pieces of space debris are jumping around in aerodynamic bliss. We've got billions of dollars in the latest technology, the most accomplished researchers and armed forces professionals, dozens of space agencies, and hundreds of private companies all freaking out about it. So we figured we'd freak out about it too.
Because space is really, really cool, and we've barely seen any of it.
That was only the piece we can see. Presumably, the universe was already infinite even then.
But asking what we're doing up there is the wrong question. We need to first ask, why? Initial space exploration had nothing to do with thrusters and exoplanets. It had everything to do with a concrete wall in a German city.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
The only reason why we went to the moon when we did with the Apollo program was political motivation. We wouldn't have gotten to the moon when we did. We would have been there decades later if we weren't going because of the Cold War and the space race. So you're right. It's those types of events that drive really the great things that we do at NASA. And of course, that's because they are tied. We're a federal agency and we're tied to congressionally approved budgets. So you have to have that kind of interest. And it has been political motivation really exclusively that seems to have driven that. But I think that going to space simply just for the fact of exploration and scientific curiosity, to me, that's enough.
While economic and national supremacy was the hand behind the hammer initially, the space race morphed into a conquest of its own, independent from the Cold War. Though some would argue that it never really morphed at all. Perhaps from the beginning, the intent of the space race was twofold: to fight supposed tyrants and to do other things.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
For the past 40 years, NASA has been doing other things. And for about half of that time, Jessica Meir has been helping them.
My next guest is a NASA astronaut who is currently in space, speaking to us from the International Space Station. Please welcome Jessica Meir.
Jessica Meir isn't just an astronaut. Her trailblazing scientific endeavors in the air and under the sea have cemented her a place in elite academic and advocacy spheres. Meir recently just came back from a 204-day work assignment in the International Space Station. We figured that she'd know a thing or two about space exploration, so we called her up.
My name is Jessica Meir, and I am a NASA astronaut, and previously, and still, of course, a scientist.
If you ask a veteran space explorer like Jessica Meir why we have space programs, the answer is simple.
As we say at NASA, off the Earth for the Earth.
We also explore because we need to. It's in our nature.
That is just a natural and innate part of us as humans to explore, to go further, to go around the corner and see what's there. And that curiosity, that scientific curiosity, that natural curiosity for all things around us that makes us explore, that is what's driving, I think, basic science.
And while we're up there, we're not going to waste our opportunities. Logistical impediments make research even more challenging in space than on Earth. But that hasn't stopped the astronauts.
The Apollo missions actually created really a revolution in the STEM field in our country. It sparked this progress in science, technology, engineering, math. It fueled all of that because we had a reason. We had something behind that. But that had many, many more implications than just the space program. It drove those fields in so many different directions, unrelated to space as well, getting people more interested in the sciences and in technology that is only going to benefit us as humans, whether it has applications toward what we're doing on the planet or off the planet. For example, the robotic arm that we had on the space shuttle and have on the space station, that actually led to the development of this device that was used to do neurosurgery in a way that was never able to be accomplished before. Everything that we're doing up there is not only benefiting us in terms of future space exploration, but it has tangible benefits back on Earth. Another easy one to describe is pharmaceutical development. One of the areas of research on the space station is growing protein crystals. So you can actually grow larger and more pure protein crystals without gravity. And that has led to the development of some very important drugs that are actually in clinical trials right now. One example is for Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. That was work that came from a Japanese study on the space station. Because you can see the structure of the protein when you're able to grow it in space, you can actually make these target therapies more effectively.
Once in a while, we have a wonderful surprise. We learned, for instance, that the person who invented the method to measure Webb telescope mirrors so we could polish them up perfectly, after he was done with that, he said, "I know how to solve a problem for eye doctors." So when you go to see your eye doctor, they use the stuff that he invented so they can see inside your eye.
Because they're off the Earth for the Earth, many of the discoveries made in the capsule confines transcend into our daily lives. Most recently, Jessica Meir and her colleagues studied the role of myostatin, a negative muscle growth regulator, in mice.
So myostatin is an inhibitor for muscle growth. It's a normal part of our physiology as humans. It is a regulator of muscle growth so that things are, you know, have some kind of level of feedback and control. So if you have individuals that lack this gene, or if you can block this process, there will be vast implications toward the development of and sustenance of muscle. So what these experimenters did was they had myostatin knockout mice. So they did not have the gene for myostatin. That was one group. Then there were, of course, control mice, like any good experiment. And then there was a group that was given a therapeutic agent where it was given injections before going to space. And also we were giving the mice injections while they were in space that basically blocked that pathway. So it was accomplishing the same kind of thing as that myostatin knockout mice, but in a different way by blocking something along the pathway. And there were some drastic differences in these groups that were really interesting. So in this study, these mice were actually able to maintain their bone density and muscle mass compared to the controls. So this really has drastic implications for what could happen for us as astronauts on long duration space travel. Of course, bone density loss and muscle mass atrophy are huge problems in space. We are able to combat those because we have incredible exercise equipment on board the space station, and we exercise every day. But when we talk about exploration missions to distant locations, when we have a much smaller volume, we won't be able to fly large pieces of equipment like that. So we do have to think about other types of strategies, including something like this, a therapeutic strategy that could benefit astronauts in the future. And again, bringing it back down to Earth, this study has a lot of applications in terms of bone and muscle degenerative conditions, osteoporosis, and other conditions with muscle atrophy on the Earth for patients that are in very critical conditions. And if we're able to apply these types of therapies eventually to humans, we might make huge progress in these disease states on Earth.
This work isn't too different from what Jessica is used to doing. In fact, it's right up her alley.
I'm a comparative physiologist, so I was specifically studying the physiology of animals in extreme environments. I was particularly interested in deep diving species like emperor penguins and elephant seals and the real elite accomplished divers, and trying to understand how they could use their oxygen stores, what is different about their body, about the way they consume or utilize or tolerate low levels of oxygen in order to accomplish those dives. So we're talking an emperor penguin can dive for 30 minutes. So air breathing, breath hold divers, just like us, but they can hold their breath for 30 minutes. An elephant seal, 2 hours on a single breath. So obviously they have a host of adaptations compared to how we would fare in that same realm. And then I studied high altitude birds. I studied the barheaded goose, the species that migrates over the Himalayas twice a year. So now, of course, they're not holding their breath, but they're flying at an altitude so high, they only have about a half or a third of the amount of oxygen that we would have here at sea level. So different hosts of adaptations, but some overlap there in terms of how these animals utilize oxygen and in these extreme environments and extreme situations. We're looking at animals in extreme environments, and now I'm the animal in the extreme environment of space.
Her training isn't in astrophysics. She isn't an Air Force pilot. She's a leading biologist, aquanaut and cavenaut. But before all else, she's curious. She told us that this is actually a reflection of a bigger trend in NASA recruitment.
Yeah, I guess it might seem like quite a leap, particularly the fact that my background's in biology, and a lot of people might think, okay, you have to have an engineering background or at least be a jet pilot or something that's more inclined toward this position as an astronaut. But these days, you know, our office is incredibly diverse. And I think that's one of the things that makes us so much more successful and makes us so much more well-fitted and well-suited toward long-duration missions. You want different points of view, different experiences, different backgrounds. It's incredibly important. We still have those jet pilots and engineers. We have a lot of engineers. I would say probably most of our degrees are engineers, but we have scientists from various backgrounds. We have medical doctors. And I think that adds and leads toward a much more successful team. The common theme for me for all of those past pursuits and my current job is that of exploration and the unknown and understanding more about the world around us.
Mir's astronaut class, the Eight Balls, were the first to be composed of equal parts men and women. Her female colleague from the same cohort, Kate Rubin, just launched last week. Nevertheless, gender and racial equality is still some ways off in STEM.
Overall, our office is probably only about a third female right now, and there's definitely a lack of minorities as well. We're trending in that right direction, but you know, it takes time to catch up, and it takes development, and it takes having those people represented well in the STEM fields, because those fields are what funnel us into being astronauts. So I think we're getting there and trending in the right direction, and I hope we continue to improve, because I do truly believe that to go to do something well, to go back to the moon, to go to Mars, we really can only do that if we include everybody, and it is for everybody.
One big step was made this time last year, though. On October 18th, 2019, this happened.
It's the 221st spacewalk to service the International Space Station, but the very first to be conducted entirely by women. Astronauts Jessica Meir and Christina Cook set out at 7:50 this morning, a six-hour mission to replace a power controller that helps regulate the station's solar panels. NASA sent the astronauts who could get the job done and then realized they'd made history.
And then this happened.
Well, they're conducting the first ever female spacewalk to replace an exterior part of the space station. They're doing some work, and they're doing it in a very high altitude, an altitude that very few people will ever see. Congratulations, Christina and Jessica, on this historic event. This is truly historic, and you're right now on television all over the world, so don't get nervous.
We don't want to take too much credit because there have been many other female spacewalkers before us. This is just the first time that there have been two women outside at the same time. And it's really interesting for us. We've talked a lot about it up here. You know, for us, this is really just us doing our job. It's something we've been training for 6 years and preparing for. And so it didn't really, you know, for us, it's just coming out here and doing our job today. And we were the crew that was tasked with this assignment. At the same time, we recognize that it is a historic achievement. And we do, of course, want to give credit to all of those that came before us. There have been a long line of female scientists, explorers, engineers, and astronauts, and we have followed in their footsteps to get us where we are today.
Now that she's back on Earth, Jessica Meir is itching to launch once more.
You know, I would love to be the person going to the moon, and I'd love to go back to the space station too. There are so many different exciting things that we're doing right now, and it will really just come down to being in the right spot at the right time and who that right team is going to be. So it's not up to me. I don't get to assign myself, but hopefully I will get to fly again.
She's especially excited about the Artemis missions, a new generation of space exploration intended to bring the first woman and next man onto the moon by 2024, and to use those established platforms to subsequently bring us to Mars by the start of the next decade.
What we're doing is the Artemis missions. Our plan is to send the first woman and the next man back to the surface of the moon, and then to go on to Mars, to create this sustainable presence around the moon, to have this gateway that we would be able to have astronauts in orbit, make landings down to the moon, use that gateway, which would be in orbit around the moon, in order to then jump to Mars. So it'd be this incremental and sustainable way of approaching it.
Based on what's happened in the past month, who knows what the next decade will look like? If you dig around NASA, though, some people are saying we won't have to wait a whole decade for a cool new project. Enter Dr. John Mather.
Det är en stor ära att få presentera Nobelpristagaren i fysik. It is a great honor to introduce the Nobel laureate in physics, Dr. John Mather.
Your Royal Highnesses, Your Excellencies, honored guests, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, thanks, Dr. Mather, but please just call us Will and Alex.
So I'm John Mather, and I'm a senior project scientist for the James Webb Space Telescope at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. And I've been there for a long time.
While we have neither the budget, nor the means, nor the personnel, nor the reputation, nor class, nor prestige, nor grandeur of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, Will can play the French horn. So here we go.
John Cromwell Mather is a senior astrophysicist at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. His work on designing the Cosmic Background Explorer satellite led him to Stockholm in 2006, where the committee said that the satellite marked the beginning of cosmology as a precision science. He was one of the 100 most influential people in the world in 2007, according to Time magazine, an alum of UC Berkeley, and the son of a dairy farmer.
NASA is a big agency, so while Dr. Mather and Dr. Meir have the same boss, their career paths couldn't be more varied. But interestingly, their childhoods weren't so different.
I always wanted to be a scientist, as far as back as I can remember what scientist was. My dad was a scientist who studied dairy cattle and statistics of dairy cattle in the Rutgers University research farm. So that's my introduction to science was living on a giant farm where other people did all the work, and I was a kid and I didn't have to milk the cows. So I had a lot of time on my hands to think about science. So when I was a kid, I thought physics was the most exciting science because it was so mysterious. And there was relativity and quantum mechanics, and they're still mysterious.
I started saying I wanted to be an astronaut when I was 5 years old. So it was always the dream career that I had. But I also had this interest in biology and nature and the world around me, and particular the incredible and diverse behaviors that are exhibited in the animal kingdom, like deep diving animals, high altitude animals, that kind of thing. So I was really exploring those paths in parallel. I pursued a degree in biology, Then I went to the International Space University in Strasbourg, France for a master's of space studies. Then I worked at NASA as a life science researcher, as I mentioned, helping coordinate the experiments that were done on the astronauts on the space shuttle at that time and also the space station, and then going on to work as a comparative physiologist, as we discussed. So for me, it was always something that was there. I always had this dream and this end goal of becoming an astronaut from the time that I was five. And it was also something that everybody associated with me, from my childhood friends growing up to my college friends, and of course, all my siblings and my parents. It was just, people called me Space Girl. It was just a thing that it was my thing, I guess. So there wasn't really a particular moment where I was like, okay, this is it. I was always interested in pursuing that path, getting involved in as many space-related activities as I could all along the way, while simultaneously pursuing that interest in biology. And then once I had the realistic requirements to apply to become an astronaut, I just started applying.
Following his undergraduate years, John was set to pursue a degree at Princeton, but a single monumental event transformed his outlook on life.
Before that, I was a postdoc at the Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York City. Before that, I was a graduate student at UC Berkeley. And before that, I was an undergraduate at Swarthmore College in suburban Philadelphia. And before that, I was a kid in northern New Jersey.
It was at UC Berkeley that his noble work began, but at the time, he had no idea.
I did a research project for my thesis in Berkeley, and it failed. However, just about the same time, I got a job offer for a postdoc position at NASA in New York City. So I said, okay, I'll do that. And then a few months later, NASA said they liked proposals for new satellite missions. I said, boss, my thesis project failed, but we should try it in outer space. And so we said, okay, we'll write a proposal. And we called up our friends and we sent it in. And that became the Cosmic Background Explorer satellite, or COBE, which actually worked because real professional engineers made it work. And it was a wonderful trip. So that got us all the way to Stockholm.
So what exactly is the Cosmic Background Explorer satellite, or COBE?
The Cosmic Background Explorer, or COBE satellite, was to observe the Big Bang, the heat radiation left over from the early universe, and also to hunt for the infrared light that might have come from the first generations of stars and galaxies born soon after.
From 1989 to 1993, just as that Berlin Wall was coming down, COBE was high above, redefining our knowledge of the cosmos. The Big Bang Theory is more than a mediocre TV show. It's a theory of everything, and it was solidified by COBE. It's far too complicated for us, so we'll let Dr. Mather take this one.
So the first question was, is the Big Bang story actually correct? So the Big Bang says, well, the early universe was very hot and very condensed. The heat radiation should still be here, and it should be following a formula called the black body formula, which is a completely definite prediction about the color. How bright is it at each different wavelength? So, okay, so first project, measure that. And we did indeed, and it turned out to be perfect, as far as anyone could tell, within about 50 parts per million. So that was my thesis project, grown up and done right. And it did work in outer space. Now, the second part was to look for the hot and cold spots in that heat radiation, because, well, if it's cosmic, it should come equally from all directions, but maybe not exactly. So then we knew that the early universe couldn't be exactly totally uniform because we're here. So the universe today is not totally uniform, so something had to happen. And calculation says we had to have some kind of seeds in the early universe. So let's look for them. That was our strategy. And so we were just barely able to detect them, but we did measure them. And so that was our second big discovery. And the two of those were the measurements that took us to Stockholm. So then we made a third discovery, which was a little harder to make, but we measured the accumulated light of the early universe galaxies, and we found out that the universe is about twice as we ever thought it would be. So that means more stars, more galaxies somehow hid themselves from us. And the interpretation would be, well, they were there all along, but the radiation was absorbed by dust grains and converted into infrared, so you couldn't see it directly with a regular telescope. So those were the three big results from that mission, and pretty exciting.
The Big Bang theory also grants the possibility for extraterrestrial life. And since Galileo, astronomers have been searching for the ET, but to no avail. Many candidates have been proposed, researched, and struck down, simply because they're too far. But maybe there's been one hiding in plain sight all along.
We are told, dramatic news overnight, that there may be some form of life on Venus.
We were fortunate enough to interview both of our friends at NASA following the news that phosphine gas has been identified on Venus. Phosphine is a toxic gas produced by certain microbes. Its presence could mean bacteria are inhabiting the planet closest to us. Dr. Muir thinks this is a brilliant moment to emphasize the power of non-hypothesis-driven research.
Given the atmospheric composition and the extreme temperatures, it wasn't necessarily considered a great candidate to look for signs of life. But I think what you raise is a really interesting point. It's also important to remember to cast that broad net. You know, how actually you do that, you know, this is a little bit outside of my realm of expertise, but I would say the encouraging point is that obviously we did find something using the approach that these investigators used in this recent study. So although we haven't been focusing on it, somebody was able to find something that is encouraging that we do want to look in further. And that's how science works. Incrementally, we're always building on the successes and the results and the failures of other scientists and of our own experiments. So I think having that, you know, it is really, you have to be doing both, casting that broad net, but also doing some very targeted, specific hypothesis-driven research as well. And I think if you boil it down in science, those are two pretty big differences in how we approach scientific problems, whether or not they're very specific hypothesis-driven, and sometimes they're not. Now, some non-hypothesis-driven research can also be very fruitful. So I think if we continue to do both, then hopefully we don't miss out on the things that we're not specifically looking for. But you do have to be able to cast that big net. And I think that sometimes that is the problem in terms of space sciences, because you don't necessarily have the funding to do it all. But the nice thing is, now that we have these results, we can build on that further. And I know that there are at least two different studies exploring Venus that are in part of this NASA Discoveries program that are being evaluated now that hopefully will go forward. And there's a European study as well, I think, geared toward Venus. So it does sound like there is interest there. There are people that are already approaching these problems and using different techniques. So hopefully we will get to the same place in the end and we'll be able to make those discoveries.
But not everyone is convinced. Dr. Mather says we should be skeptical.
I would be pretty surprised if that turns out to be a correct observation, number one, because it's a difficult observation. And so far, I really don't think life is very likely on Venus. So that means either we made a mistake or we don't understand enough chemistry yet. That's the if you're an observer or an experiment builder, you always say, I might have made a mistake. It's just the thing that you're always thinking, how could I have fooled myself, or how could nature have fooled me this time? On the other hand, looking at the larger question of, is there life elsewhere in the universe? Well, sure, why not? What makes us think that our spot is so special that it's the only spot? It even begins to look like it might be a thermodynamic imperative that given the chance, life would develop. So we have just one place where we know anything about it, and that's here on Earth. We know that life left fossils soon after there was an ocean, and that's pretty quick, within a few hundred million years. So that says, well, maybe it is a thermodynamic imperative to have life when you can. On the other hand, we also know that it took all of time, all the rest of time, for us to turn up. I think my opinion would be life is common, and civilized life like ours is very rare.
Regardless, this new age of space exploration has brought on a slew of private, public, and national partnerships, unheard of in a discipline that was previously infatuated with competition and bringing down the Sputniks.
Elon Musk's SpaceX made headlines earlier this year when one of its boosters carried humans as opposed to cargo. What few people realize, however, is that NASA is extremely reliant upon independent contractors and private partnerships, and it has been for a while.
NASA has always worked in partnership with private contractors. Most of the work that's done in our programs is done by companies, contract to NASA. So what SpaceX and some of the others are now pioneering is, well, they'll just do the engineering and they'll sell us the product. It used to be that we'd tell companies how to do what we asked them to do. SpaceX said, no, don't bother telling us. We'll figure that out. And we have a business that we can get paid a lot of money by launching things for everyone. So they figured out how to do that. So I'm really pleased to see that somebody else can take something that's fairly routine. Launching rockets over and over again is not really a new idea. And find a way to do it safely and more cheaply.
And partnerships extend beyond legal contracts. Dr. Mir thinks one of the best things to come out of ramping up space programs has been ameliorated relations between the East and the West.
And the international relationships that we're also able to explore given space. A great example there is our partnership with the Russians. You know, politically, we're in a very difficult place right now in this country with Russia as a country, but space is above that. Literally, space has been above that. Space is a place where we have been able to live and work successfully in a partnership with the Russians on the International Space Station. And that is a truly great thing. It has so many implications for life on our planet. It was, for me, you know, one of the best things about going to space for me was the training that I had living and training in Russia, immersing in that culture, learning how to fly a Russian spacecraft in Russian. I mean, these are really incredible things that show when we put our differences aside and work together, what we can accomplish.
Dr. Mather knows the importance of these international joint efforts as the James Webb Space Telescope is being built between the European Space Agency, the Canadian Space Agency, and NASA. It will have taken 25 years, but this time next year, a $10 billion satellite will launch 1 million miles away from the Earth to be the flagship successor of the Hubble. John Mather, he's a project scientist.
What is the James Webb Space Telescope, or JWST?
Well, Alex, I'm glad you asked. A gold-plated beryllium...
No, Will, not you. I was asking John. Once again, take it away.
James Webb Space Telescope is the planned successor for the Hubble Space Telescope. When we got the Hubble up and working and got it fixed after it was initially out of focus, we looked at the pictures and they said, oh, this is wonderful, but you know, we still can't see what we hoped we would see. So a committee was formed to write a book, and they wrote a beautiful book called HST, that's Hubble Space Telescope, and Beyond. And in that book, they said, please build us another more powerful telescope that's bigger and can pick up infrared light, because that's something the Hubble can't do very well. And by the way, while you're at it, please also think about how to detect and measure little planets like Earth. They're out there orbiting around other stars. So NASA said, okay, we'll do that. And so the Webb telescope is the one that they called for in the little book. And we are still working on the technology to see those little planets. So how does the Webb telescope work? Well, it is, number one, it's got to be cold so it can pick up the infrared light. If it were warm, like the Hubble, it would emit infrared light of its very own, and you wouldn't be able to use it for a telescope. So then we say, how do you get it cold? Well, let's put it far away from Earth so that Earth doesn't warm it up. So we end up in deep space. So we put it about 1 million miles away from Earth, around a place called a Lagrange point. And that's hard enough, but we know how to do that. And we've been doing it for many years, actually, with smaller equipment. But then the hard part is, well, okay, make it bigger than the Hubble telescope. And so make it a lot bigger, because it needs to be very sensitive to pick up those most distant objects. And that means make it fold up. So instead of a single giant mirror like the Hubble telescope has, we have an even bigger mirror, but it's made out of 18 smaller pieces. And so make this folding telescope and learn how to focus it after launch when it is cold. So this is a huge engine challenge, and it's one which we have mastered. So now our job is to get it there and make it work, just as the design says. So what are we going to do with it after we get there? We pointed at basically everything we already know about and see how different it looks at the wavelengths that we'll be able to now pick up, which are from 0.6 microns, which you can see with your eye, out to about 28 microns, which you definitely cannot. We think the universe is going to look quite different. We will be able to see farther because the early universe is receding from us at great speed. So the light that started out as ultraviolet light, looks to us like infrared. We will be able to see inside dusty clouds of gas. You know, there's beautiful clouds they take pictures of with the Hubble where stars are being born. And we will be able to see inside, see how do the stars get born inside those clouds. Infrared light will go through the dust grains, or I should say around the dust grains, so we can see the stars being born inside. And I guess the third thing that we can do is pick up the heat from things that are not warm enough to send out starlight. So you sitting there, I'm sitting here, each of us is sending out 500 watts of infrared power. And if we were in outer space, we'd be able to detect that quite well. In fact, the Webb telescope is so extraordinarily sensitive that if you were a bumblebee hovering at the distance of the moon, we would be able to pick you up. We'd be able to see you both from the reflected sunlight that you would have and also from the heat that you would send out. And so anyway, it's an extraordinary thing that we're building. We were certainly expecting some wonderful surprises when we get it up there. Closest to home, we'd love to see planets. But they're very hard to see, and this is not the telescope that you would design just to see planets. But we will be looking at them and hunting for signs of them, and we do expect some lovely surprises there too. So that's the quick summary. Oh, I should tell you, who was Mr. Webb? Why are we naming the telescope after James Webb? He was the second administrator of NASA. And so he was the person who organized us to go to the moon and did it beautifully. And he also said, Mr. President, we should get some science out. Can we please start up some science laboratories around the country? And can we please send out some interplanetary probes? So we sent out the probes past Jupiter and Saturn to Uranus and Neptune. We sent probes to Mars. And so he got us started in a lot of wonderful scientific directions. So he's the first NASA administrator that's got a telescope named for him. But I think it's a suitable honor for such an amazing person.
Launching the James Webb Space Telescope, buying Jessica Meir some mice, it's expensive stuff. And unfortunately, as with other scientific research, it's been largely neglected in recent decades. NASA's budget was 0.5% of the US GDP last year, and only a portion of that goes to space exploration. From the people within the field, it's clear that it isn't enough.
One part in a thousand of the gross domestic product, that's an extremely tiny fraction. And what fraction of that is for science? Well, maybe a third. What fraction of that is for astronomy? Maybe a quarter of that. So space science is actually an extremely tiny fraction of the budget. And we've got a lot of other big things that we do. Also, to put into perspective, the worldwide space budget of all government agencies and other private stuff is currently around $340 billion. So what is that all going to? Well, I've heard, by the way, that the budget for GPS systems, so you can find out where you are when you're driving, is actually bigger than the NASA budget. So that's kind of crazy, but how many GPS systems have you bought? Well, probably more than one.
Probably the biggest problem toward accomplishing anything in space then is the budget. We need the right resources behind it. And that goes back to the very first question and what we talked about with Apollo. The reason why Apollo was successful was because it had an incredible amount of not only political motivation, but the right resources behind it. That Apollo program alone, and we're not talking about the entire NASA budget, we're talking just about the Apollo program, it was 4% of GDP. Currently, the entire NASA budget is about 0.04%. So we are talking orders of magnitude lower. And if you're thinking about accomplishing something equally as great, like going back to the moon or going to Mars, we're going to need to put those resources behind it. And I think that's one of the things that, because we haven't done that since Apollo, we haven't had that. I think that some of our leaders don't necessarily understand the level of investment that it would take to do this. What we're doing is taking the right approach by having partnerships with commercial entities like, for example, SpaceX and Boeing, building these vehicles to take us to the International Space Station so that then we can focus our NASA resources on the Orion capsule, which will enable these further destination missions. So we're trying to approach it in different ways, but I think we're still going to need to have that big push, that big investment in resources. And that is the biggest challenge, I think, that we face really for any great goal, any truly novel space-related mission.
Coming back down to Earth, it seems that there isn't enough funding for anything in 2020. This pandemic has devastated both commerce and communities. Though we finished our season on COVID-19, we couldn't help but ask Jessica for some advice.
You see, Dr. Mir was in space for 7 whole months. That's the amount of time you've been holed in at home. When she left, things felt relatively normal. She came back to a world that would make science fiction novelists jealous, but not for the right reasons. She is one of 3 humans untouched by the pandemic for several months, and as a result, she's gained an unparalleled understanding of what it means to be isolated.
Isolation is part of our mission in space. We expect it, we train for it, and there's a very good reason for it. If you look out the window, there's a vacuum of space which cannot support us. So there's a very good reason why we are in isolation there. And I think going into it with that expectation is one thing. The second thing is that you're experiencing such incredible things. You're weightless. You're performing different job tasks that are incredibly focused and incredibly interesting and breathtaking. And it's a novel alien environment. So that isolation is just part of it. You don't miss the other things. But if you contrast that with what's happening on Earth, our society on this planet is not built that way. We don't expect isolation. The human psyche is not really built for that. We don't flourish in those kind of conditions. So I think it's, you know, people ask me a lot of times in space what I missed. And the answer truly was that I didn't miss anything, which actually did surprise me a little bit. But I think it's because of that alien environment. If you go somewhere new, also somewhere new that happens to be spectacular, you don't really miss anything because it's just a new place. If you're sitting on your couch the whole time and you take out something that you're used to having, then of course you miss it because you're used to having that in this environment. And I think that's the big difference with what's happening now, given the pandemic. Our lives are drastically different. We are all missing major components about our lives that we're used to having. This interaction with others, physical touch, just gathering in spaces together and going out and doing things. It's not how our society is built. It's not what we're used to as humans. So I actually find it much more challenging, the isolation and confinement that I came back to on this completely changed planet, than anything that I dealt with in space. And I think, yeah, it certainly will have some psychological consequences. You know, for us in space, we select astronauts that are probably going to do well in those types of scenarios. So we deal with it with our selection, with our training, with maintenance, because we have incredible psychological support groups. We have things in place to help ease those kind of things. On the Earth, everybody is subjected to this right now. We can't pick which people we think might do better with it and which people might not. Everybody's subjected to it. So I think the consequences here on Earth are probably going to be much more extreme than with, say, a standard astronaut population in terms of how they're dealing with it. But it is a very difficult situation, and I think it's just something that people are just having to accept. I think what we're going through right now is this kind of level of people are just over it. They're tired of it. They get it. Some people understand it. They understand the problem, but they're tired of it. They want to do something else. And so it's really difficult to keep those impositions on yourself when, you know, you want so badly to do something else. But I think, you know, there are important things that can help. And some of these things we talked a lot about and made some videos. You talk about keeping a routine, keeping an exercise regime. That's so important, not just for your physical well-being, but your psychological well-being too. Communicating well with others and just thinking a little bit differently about these close relationships that you have. I think you can, you know, maybe make little surprises or do little things outside of the norm to help keep things interesting, but it certainly is difficult and everybody has different ways of dealing with it. I don't know, long-term wise, I think the biggest impact will probably be toward younger kids that are dealing with this right now, because they haven't even developed all of those strategies for them and the ramifications that will be imposed, I think, on them once we've returned to a slightly more normal life. Hopefully we will eventually get there. I think it's going to be most difficult for those kids that have had to kind of endure this sudden change and shift in what they would naturally be doing.
On this episode of The Finch, we talked about the spatial playground, Berlin, the first all-female spacewalk, bodybuilder mice, California beaches, toxic bacterial gases on Venus, a billion-dollar telescope, a cash-strapped country, and what it means to be alone.
Some people seem to think that they need to decide whether or not they believe in science. And I always like the way Neil deGrasse Tyson puts that. The thing about science is it's true whether or not you believe in it. And that is exactly what science is. It's not a belief. It is fact. So it is a little bit disheartening to me sometimes that people can, that people do question it and question that simple aspect. A fact is a fact. It's not a belief.
We are sitting here on our little planet made out of exploded stars.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Finch. Feel free to email us at contact@thefinchpodcast.com if you have any questions or suggestions. And we want to thank the folks over at NASA for making this dream episode become a reality.
Make sure you follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at The Finch Podcast, that's lowercase, no space, and leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this episode if you liked it.
In the next episode, we're back to our climate series. In episode 3, we'll be speaking with Dr. Robert O. Mendelson from Yale University about climate econometrics.
You have adventures coming. Maybe that is actually part of the answer to your question. What is the future going to hold? It's going to be adventures for all of us.
Stay safe, everyone. This was Extempore 6.